section after reading several times the Gospel's accounts of Jesus' betrayal, trial, crucifixion, and death. I also read quite a few good commentaries. And as I read, I did listen and waited on God to show me what he wanted me to share. And I did feel God lead me as I prepared this reflection. It always encourages me when I see and sense God confirming my plans. And in fact, Daniel's Palm Sunday sermon last week gave me confirmation, as there are so many parallels that I'll be drawing and sharing tonight from Daniel's preach last week. And then this morning, there's a Lent series that I've been following. And the message that they had today also gave me quite a bit of confirmation. So I just pray that the Lord will use me today as he desires, and that what I share will bring praise and glory to his name. So Good Friday, and borrowing from Daniel's sermon title last week, Jesus's experience in the city of terror continues. We remember Jesus willingly suffering and dying on the cross as the greatest sacrifice for our sins. And we know that Easter Sunday is coming, which is the glorious celebration of the day Jesus was raised from the dead, proclaiming his victory over sin and death, and pointing ahead to a future resurrection for all of us who are united in to him by faith. So what we remember today is entirely appropriate, because the suffering and death of Jesus, as terrible as it was, marked the dramatic conclusion of God's plan to save his people from their sins. So I've titled this reflection, it's quite a long title, "The Greatest and Only Sign We Need, The Quiet Sign of Calvary Love." And the text that I picked for it is from Mark 15, 29 to 32. And Isabel kindly offered to be the one to read it for me today, and she's here. So Isabel, do you want to unmute and read it, please?
It's not very loud, so I thought you'd have more trouble listening.
Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "So, you are who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days. Come down from the cross and save yourself." In the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. "He saved others," they said, "but he can't save himself. Let this Messiah, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross, that we may see and believe." Those crucified with him also heaped insults on him.
Unmute, Mercy.
Sorry about that. Thanks, Isabel. I don't know what feelings these verses evoke in you. As I read the Gospels over and over and read these words as I was preparing for today, I couldn't help but hear statements and comments that I hear every day around me, at work, everywhere. Just things like, "Show us what you're made of," or "You're not good enough," or "You're a failure," or "Sell yourself a bit more." It's always about things that are the appearance on the outside, individualistic thinking, like expectations, measuring people by world standards. And just going back to that text that Isabel has read, what did those passers-by want to see? What about the chief priests and the teachers of the law? and even those Jesus was crucified with. They wanted a sign. They wanted yet another sign from Jesus. If you read again in verse 32, it says, "Let this Messiah, this King of Israel, come down now from the cross, that we may see and believe." But were they wanted more proof and more signs. But were they right to ask for more proof? Do we think they would have believed if they got more proof? I'll just let you sit with this question for a minute. And there'll be a lot of questions in this reflection. That's why I titled this a reflection. So we'll kind of just, I'll throw them out and then I'll talk us through what I think the responses are. So let us sit with this question and then we'll come back to it shortly. In the meantime, I did a bit of research to find out the biblical meaning of signs and wonders. And I'll only focus on signs, but oftentimes signs and wonders go together. Signs are events which unquestionably involve an immediate and powerful action of God, which is designed to reveal his character or purposes. And the basic nature of a sign is that it points people to God. And signs seek to bring belief, but they don't compel a person to believe. And my rent's reflection this morning, it was all about the signs of life that we have seen throughout the Lent series. And Jesus being the one whom all these signs of life stem from, because Jesus is love. He's the one who bore life for us. And this morning when I took the kids on the Easter QR trail that was organized by Reverend Emma from St. Barnabas Church, I just couldn't help but notice all the signs of life everywhere that we went. I mean, just buds coming alive, the colors of the trees, the sky. So there's lots of signs of life out there. And it's not wrong to see a sign and be drawn to Christ by it. After all, if you think of Jesus's ministry whilst he was on earth, if somebody was sick, if they had a sick son or daughter who was sick or dying, or even a close friend or relative, Jesus gave so many personal examples to show that prayers to God to heal people were not only desirable, but doing so was an essential practice of Jesus in ordinary circumstances. And we also see, we know that the apostles in Acts did lots of signs. And we can read that in Acts 5, verse 12. The apostles performed many signs and wonders among the people, and all the believers used to meet together in Solomon's colonnade. And Jesus himself in John 14, verse 11, says, "Believe me when I say that I am in the Father and the Father is in me. Or at least believe on the evidence of the works themselves." But what about the chief priests and the scribes you've read about in Mark 15? There was obviously something very wrong here going on with them. And this is what I kind of want us to reflect on and just think of and maybe try and notice and avoid in our lives. So just going back to that question that I posed earlier, would they have believed if Jesus had come down from the cross? It's a tricky question. And I think it can be both a yes and a no. So I think yes, they would have believed, but then the Christ would not have been the Christ they were rejecting. But it's also a no, because they wouldn't have believed on the kind of Christ who came to be, to serve, not to be served, but to serve and to die. In fact, to die for the sake of love. He didn't fit the picture they had in mind. And it was his suffering that was the offense, really. They did not expect a suffering Messiah. That just takes me to the next question that I want us to just reflect on and think about. How do we know that they would not have believed in this way? Daniel touched on this last Sunday in his sermon as well. We know they wouldn't have believed in this way because the raising of Lazarus after 4 days of death was an even greater sign than a wounded man pulling himself down from the cross. But what was the response of these people, the Jews and everybody who was around? You can find the response in John 11, 45. John 11, 45 to 48. And we read this last week as well. Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. What are we accomplishing? They asked. Here is this man performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. They did not believe even this greater sign. So there's no way they would have believed in Jesus if he came down from the cross. And that takes me to the next question for us to ponder. So what was wrong with these religious leaders? Why were they so closed to the signs that Jesus did and so demanding that he always do something more and do something greater? The clue for us again is in Mark 15, the verse that Isabel read for us in verse 31, taking us back to verse 31. In the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. He saved others, they said, but he can't save himself. Just notice the word can't there. Why do they assume he cannot? Because the possibility that he would not if he could is inconceivable to their kind of hearts. They have no heart for love or mercy or compassionate self-sacrifice. And we see this, Jesus tells us, gives us an example in Matthew 9:13 says, go and learn what it means, what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice. They're morally incapable of making sense of one who saves others and freely chooses not to save himself, because in not saving himself, he goes on saving others. That is so foreign to their set of priorities. They can only mock it. So let's just go a bit deeper with that, with another question, just to help us build up on this. So what's their priority that makes them so blind to the truth and love of Christ? I'm going to take us again to another part in Mark 15, verse 9 to 10, which reads, do you want me to release to you the King of the Jews? Asked Pilate, knowing it was out of self-interest that the chief priests had handed Jesus over to him. So my Bible is the NIV Bible, it uses self-interest. But when I read it in the New King James Version, it uses envy in place of self-interest. Both of those words are very egocentric words. But what does envy mean? Envy is a resentful feeling that someone is getting something that you want instead. And what was Jesus getting? He was getting a following. He was becoming a hero. The common people heard him gladly. The religious hold on the people that the priests had was being loosened. They were losing their esteem and power and praise. This is what blinded them to the truth and love of Christ. Their love for the praise of men. And John 5:43-45 tells us more on that. I have come in my Father's name, and you do not accept me. But if someone else comes in his own name, you will accept him. How can you believe since you accept glory from one another, but do not seek the glory that comes from the only God? How can you believe, Jesus asks? You can't. When you and I are in love with the praises of men, we are blinded to the truth of Christ. Because Christ lived for the joy of others, not the exaltation of himself at others' expense. He was unwilling to come down from the cross because he had come not to be served, but to serve and suffer for the sake of others. If we have a love affair with the praises of men, we will be so offended at Jesus that we will just mock him. And this leads me to something important about signs and wonders and the cross. These people demanded a sign because they were blind to the wonder of love. And they were blind to the wonder of love because they loved the ego boost of men's praise. This sheds a lot of light as well on what Jesus said about their sign seeking earlier on in his ministry. We can read that in Matthew 16. Verse 1-4, which says, the Pharisees and Sadducees came to Jesus and tested him by asking him to show them a sign from heaven. He replied, when evening comes, you say, it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, today it will be stormy, for the sky is red and overcast. You know how to interpret the appearance of the sky, but you cannot interpret the signs of the times. A wicked and adulterous generation looks for a sign, but none will be given it except the sign of Jonah. Jesus then left them and went away. So here Jesus admits that there are signs, but these guys were demanding a sign from heaven. They wanted something more than Jesus was offering. They wanted something that would take away the worldly offense of Jesus' lowliness and insignificance. Something that would really rock the Romans and knock people into submission to the Jews. And we notice he also says something startling in that same part. He says, an evil and adulterous generation seek a sign. What does he mean by the word adulterous in this section? Adultery, as used here, is having another lover besides God. Because God being the husband of Israel, Israel is the bride. So these people loved the praises of men. They loved the world and its approval and comfort. They loved the prominent seats at dinners. They loved greetings in marketplaces. They loved exalted titles. And even more, in Luke 16:14, it says, the Pharisees who loved money heard all this and were sneering at Jesus. They were lovers of money. Since money more than anything else has the potential to give a sense of power and esteem. I just have a few more questions. We're nearly there. So why does this kind of generation seek a sign? Why do these people seek a sign? Because asking for more and more evidence, and especially evidence of worldly attention seeking, attention getting power, is a disguise for the love of the world. If he doesn't give this sign, then they say they don't have to believe in him in his weaknesses. If he did give the kind of sign they wanted, it would have simply confirmed to them in their worldliness. So how does Jesus respond? And we can see this across his full ministry. When he'd left the wilderness after fasting for 40 days and after the devil had tempted him and told him to jump from to jump that God will catch him and he won't fall, Jesus said no. When Peter, at the point when Judas had betrayed him and he was being taken away by the soldiers, when Peter tried to say, don't go, by chopping the soldier's ear, Jesus said no. When the priests, as I've read in some of the verses, asked for a sign from heaven, he said no. And when the chief priests on that cross was asking him to come down, Jesus said no. Why? Why do we think Jesus said no? Was it because he would give no sign at all? I don't think so. It's because he wanted to give the quiet sign of Calvary love for those who have eyes to see. If he saved himself, he would not save others. You and I would not be saved. And we read that in John 12, verse 24. Very truly, I tell you, unless a grain of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds. And also in Romans 5, verse 8, it reads, but God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. So Jesus was giving a sign, not a flashy sign that would sway people to bow without a change of heart, or would confirm them in their own love for praise. He was giving a sign of love. And so just to conclude, I'd just like us to ask ourselves, how personally should we take this sign of love? Should you and I just feel personally loved this way, just this evening, and maybe tomorrow morning, tomorrow evening, and Easter Sunday? Or should it just remain a kind of general great history event that we think about deeply and admire on Good Friday and Easter Sunday every year? I pray that it's the former, that we feel personally loved yesterday, today, and forever because of his greatest sign, quiet sign on the cross at Calvary. Amen.
Thank you, Mercy. I'll hand over to Daniel for communion.
Thank you, Marie, for leading us in a time of worship through beautifully selected songs. And thank you, Mercy, for sharing these reflections with us. Listening to what you had to share, I have decided to adapt a little bit what I have prepared for communion, and I'll try to somehow work with both what I have prepared and the fresh inspiration. Just so you know, all of you who gather tonight, it is our practice for at least since I started the George Road that we empower people in our congregation to serve. And I'm thrilled that Mercy is one of them, and she took the courage to share this reflection with us. She did it for the second time in our church. She did it under my authority as a pastor, according to the way we believe and understand the scriptures. And she has been part of the preaching class that I conducted a few years ago. I'm looking forward to start a new one, and new members maybe will join. So together with Andy, Mark in the past, and we are looking forward to see others and others rising and being willing to share God's word with us. Now, as we approach communion and listening especially to this reflection, we all know that communion in itself is a sign. And every time we celebrate, that is a sign that points to Jesus and what he has done for us. Yes, like then, in our days, people still request all kinds of signs, but this is what I made a note here. When we base our faith on signs, no sign will ever be enough. Signs are only indicators towards something greater. All kinds of signs. They are only indicators towards something greater. It's like when you drive and you follow the signs on the road, you know, signpost towards Acocks Green, towards Birmingham City Center, and so ever. When you follow those signs, they are not the place in itself. They just indicate towards a place. And throughout his life, Jesus Christ gave plenty signs, and the greatest one, as Mercy said, culminated on Calvary. But for people who base their or try to base their faith on signs, no sign will ever be enough. They will say, give me 1,000 signs and I will believe. And you give them 1,000 signs and they will say, give me one more. You give that one more and they will say, give me one more. And they will never, never manage to have proper or genuine faith based on signs, unless they discover that relationship, unless they follow where the signs indicate.